Welcome to NucleCast, the official podcast of the AMWA Deterrence Center. Our host is Dr. Adam Laufer, co-founder and vice president for research at the National Institute for Deterrence Studies. The AMWA Deterrence Center is a 501c3 organization ensuring a broader understanding of the nation's strategic nuclear deterrence and its ongoing modernization. Thank you for listening and welcome to the show. The views of the host and the guests are their own.
Welcome back to another exciting episode of NucleCast. Of course, I'm your host, Adam Lowther, and today I have another great guest. I always have great guests. This is the great thing about NucleCast is we always have great guests. And so I'm talking about James Graham Wilson, who is a historian at the State Department. And he, you know, I had seen some of his work in other areas, but now he is totally blown up because he has written a great book called America's Cold Warrior, Paul Nitzer and National Security from Roosevelt to Reagan. And, you know, it's a book about, Paul Nitzer, who was a, you know, sort of central figure in national security in the nuclear sphere for decades. I mean, he's got a school named after him. And so, you know, important player. And so, James, welcome to NucleCast. It's great to have you here.
Thank you so much for having me, Adam. I'm a big fan of the podcast. That I listen to it frequently on the way into to D.C. And it's wonderful to hear talk about nuclear weapons that when stuck in traffic on 66. And, you know, I've written this book about Paul Nitzer in my unofficial capacity. And I really try to trace his career and his extraordinary life. You know, he's with his family in the mountains, mountain climbing in Italy, you know, at the outbreak of the First World War. And then there's a sort of an incredible symmetry to his life where he is supposed to meet then National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice at the school named after him, to which you reference. And she's supposed to give a speech about the importance of missile defense. And of course, that date turns out to be September 11th, 2001. So the speech is postponed. But, you know, the broader sweep of the book is that I try to make the point that I think nobody else had more sustained influence, whether in government or shaping the strategic debates from the outside throughout this time period than Paul Nitzer. And I think his legacy is important even today.
Yeah, I mean, for folks who, you know, study sort of Cold War history, Cold War, focused on national security issues, you can't help but see his name just peppered everywhere. So I think it goes without saying the impact that he had. But start us kind of off in the beginning, like, who was this guy and how did he get to the position that he was so influential across Republican, Democrat administrations over decades?
Well, so he was the son of a very prominent professor of Romance languages at the University of Chicago. And he was a kind of rebellious youth who clearly was very smart and almost went to college at age 16. But then, you know, ultimately has a rebellious streak but still winds up graduating from Harvard. And he has a sort of chip on his shoulder about not wanting to go into academia, but at the same time, he wants the kind of recognition of being a strategic or a thinker, you know, recognized thinker. But he saw his dad and his friends, and he writes about this, that, you know, they were the smartest people in the world, but they were having no influence. They were having no access to the levers of power. And he's thinking through this as a student in the aftermath of the First World War. And he really resolves himself to wanting to make change, to be a man of action. And so in the late 1920s, 1930s, he gets involved in New York in investment banking. And it's a really kind of wild time. He's getting up to all sorts of hijinks. I mean, there's a part I love, which is sort of independent from his actual investment banking work. He's investing in what today would be like a soda stream enterprise. And he's also trying to spread rumors that Coca-Cola and Pepsi-Cola cause sterility. And, you know, this is just like one of several business ventures that are a bit off the wall. One of them succeeds quite well, actually, and it's later bought by a French pharmaceutical company. So he, you know, he makes a good amount of money in, on Wall Street, et cetera, in the 1930s. And he goes back, tries to get a start a PhD in sociology at Harvard, and then, you know, basically winds his way to Washington as World War II is taking hold in East Asia and then in Europe. And he's kind of affixed himself to James Forrestal. And so I think it's in 1940 or so that he goes to Washington, and he really never leaves.
Yeah. So how did he go from sort of this, when you say he affixed himself to Forrestal, what does that mean? And what does that, you know, how do you go from sort of a wanderer who's done a few things to being this central character in American Cold War history?
Well, I mean, back up a moment to what I think is a sort of crystallizing moment to him, which is that Clarence Dillon, the man who ran the banking firm that he worked, that he sort of with him, I think at a certain point when I'm forgetting the exact details, but he sort of he observes him calling up people around the world and telling them what to do. And he sort of thinks that this is how actually great decisions get made. It's you know, these levers of influence. And he sees in Forrestal a kind of younger version of that. And when Forrestal, who was called upon by FDR to come down to D.C., and Forrestal writes Nitzan and says, come down, like, by the weekend. And he's there, and he's works in a number of sort of interesting and important roles during the wartime D.C., working for, Nelson Rockefeller, just a list of names that you'll hear about later, Henry Wallace. And, you know, he's somebody who's sort of really, I think, disgusted by partisan politics, and he gets that from his time in New York City. He sees the sort of Democratic machine as something that he dislikes. He actually personally dislikes Franklin Roosevelt. He switches parties several times, but it doesn't really, you know, matter to him. And then when he's put in charge during the World War II FDR administration of sort of collecting important strategic minerals from Latin America, he has a lot of geologists that he hires that he gets grief from because they're registered Republicans. And, you know, he just doesn't have time to deal with the partisan politics. But he just keeps, figuring out, okay, who is somebody who really inspires me? And he goes to work for them. And that really gets him, you know, I think that it's particularly for people who are interested in you know, getting into this area. I mean, I make the point in the book that he is really the first person who creates national security as a career. And, you know, basically everyone else who comes after him is in some sense following in his footsteps, because he's not a military officer, so he has no kind of clear trajectory of, you know, what to aspire to next. He is not a foreign service officer, so he has no onward assignment. He just kind of keeps working on projects that are interesting to him. And so he goes, you know, say in the book, from 1941, somebody who has really no experience in what we now think of as national security, to 1944, 45, he's working for the Strategic Bombing Survey, first in Europe and then in Japan. And he's actually, like, briefing the U.S. military establishment, the very highest levels, of what he thinks should be changes to their overall strategy of strategic bombing, etc. So he kind of quickly gains confidence to, put himself in these positions.
Yeah. And so, you know, the war's over. And, you know, the Cold War's beginning. How does he start playing a role at that sort of transitional phase?
Yeah, that's a really important, I think, this decisive moment, right? At the end of 1945, there are a lot of the sort of people who were the so-called wise men of this period. A lot of them sort of go back to their jobs, whether it's big law firms, big investment houses. And even when he's working on the strategic bombing survey, this is in Japan, after Japan surrenders, he goes to Japan and effectively becomes the lead author of the report. And he takes the lead when they meet with President Truman to talk about it. Truman says, almost as an aside, while you're at it, meaning that the purpose was supposed to be to determine the effectiveness of strategic bombing in terms of, you know, wearing down enemy morale, et cetera, that Truman says, you know, figure out why they attacked us in the first place. And Nitzer really takes this and runs with it. And so throughout late 1945, early 46, as he's working on the Pacific War survey, he basically lays out, articulates what becomes a foundational creed to him for the rest of his life, which is that the reason why Japan attacked the United States at Pearl Harbor in December of 1941 was because the United States had let its strength atrophy, and that this weakness was provocative, and, you know, we saw the consequences. But meanwhile, you know, while he's writing this and thinking this, he's also looking out at what's happening with the Soviet Union and the collapse of the wartime alliance. And he's saying, well, we're seeing the same thing happen now. You know, while we're having rapid demobilization in early 1946 and a real intent to reduce defense spending. But ultimately, you know, at the start, he's ignored. I mean, he's told by Dean Acheson, you know, I think you're seeing ghosts. And then it I think greatly annoys him when a couple weeks after that, George Kennan writes his long telegram after the so-called Stalin election speech. And James Forrestal is the one responsible for, you know, distributing it around D.C. and telling everybody that they should be reading it. So it's just frustrated by that.
Yeah. Professional, you know, I wish I would have been that influential kind of stuff.
Well, it comes down to writing. I mean, it is true. I would say demonstrably true that Kennan was a better writer than Paul Knitson. I think that's an important lesson for all aspiring national security types.
So the Cold War's kicking off, and what is Knitson doing? What is he doing? What is he advocating?
Well, he's, you know, the first couple of years, he spends a lot of time working on the Marshall Plan, first in kind of helping to craft it, then helping to sell it to Congress. You know, it takes about a year before we get Congress to ratify the Marshall Plan. But then he really, the period, I would say, where he really becomes quite influential is starting in the really, from the U.S. perspective, terrible summer of fall of 1949. And, you know, I should step back here, and I try to say in the book that there are these periods in the Cold War that are sort of really awful and challenging for the U.S. foreign policy. But then, I have a hard time figuring out, like, the moments when things are not so challenging. But I do think that, you know, starting in the, you know, summer and fall of 1949, when you have the evidence that the Soviets have detonated an atomic device, you have the triumph of the Chinese Communist Revolution, and you have sort of yet another iteration of the decline of the British Empire, that this is a really challenging time. And Nitze steps up. He becomes deputized by Dean Acheson to work on a study of whether the U.S. should pursue work on the hydrogen bomb, the thermonuclear device. And, you know, he's really in his element there, because I think, again, with the confidence that he had achieved first and being on Wall Street among very powerful people and then dealing with the military in World War II, that he savors this notion of bringing Edward Teller in and, you know, going up on the chalkboard and writing stuff with him. I have no idea whether Nitze understood anything of what Teller was writing on the chalkboard, but he sort of really loved doing it. And so he writes up this report that for Acheson to pursue the hydrogen bomb. And then there's also a crystallizing moment for Nitze in January of 1950, in which, as I'm sure you know, and your listeners know or recall, that Truman is presented with this report, very long and elaborate report, and his response is basically, can the Russians do it? And, you know, the answer is yes. And he said, well, then we have to. And I think that from Nitze's point of view, there were two maybe presidents that he really liked over the years, and one was Truman and Reagan. And he sort of, to him, this was a very appealing quality, that you could just cut through all of the gobbledygook and ask the penetrating question and sort of make a quick decision. And so, you know, what I think, again, your listeners probably know this, or viewers, that I think sometimes I think that what becomes NSC 68 in 1950 sometimes gets conflated with the decision to pursue the hydrogen bomb. But it's really actually the commission is sort of what would U.S. strategic interests look like in the world where the hydrogen bomb is probably a thing. And so he, you know, in about 6 to 8 weeks, he leads the drafting of NSC 68. Doesn't write it all himself. I actually don't think he writes a lot of it himself. But the, you know, that it becomes a clear articulation of, you know, how we got to this situation, the collapse of the kind of interwar years, why World War II happened, and, you know, what we should do going onward, and a recapitulation of, you know, the fundamental ideals of the American founding documents, the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution. And, you know, NHTSA's will forever be linked to that, to NSC 68. And to the extent that it calls for real change, it's basically we need to really increase the defense budget dramatically because the atrophy of American power has invited Soviet weakness. American weakness has invited Soviet aggression, and we're seeing in the world of 1950 something similar to what we saw in 1939 and 1940.
Well, it's that time in the show where we have to take a quick break. But when we come back, I want you to give me sort of the 3 to 5 most important things you think NHTSA did. So you're listening to NucleCast, and we'll be right back.
This episode of NucleCast is brought to you by the Ann Law Deterrence Center, whose mission is to educate Americans about the nuclear enterprise and strategic deterrence.
And we're back, and we're talking to James Graham Wilson, who is the author of America's Cold Warrior. That's a book about Paul NHTSA. I'm sure everyone's read it. If you haven't, go get your copy. So for NHTSA, what were his most important contributions?
Well, one, I would say, is his ability to shape the terms of debates at high levels. And this is where I think it becomes quite interesting what happens when the Dwight Eisenhower administration comes in 1953. NHTSA is initially expecting to stay on. He sees himself above or below politics, however you want to see it. And he's initially given a job of the Assistant Secretary of Defense for National Security Affairs, and then John Foster Dulles walks it back. But one of the things that's intriguing to me is that even when he's not directly in the Eisenhower administration, he's involved in these studies such as the Gaither Commission and several others that really, you know, first he's drawing a big critique of John Foster Dulles' Massive Retaliation. But at the same time, Dulles has him in. You know, they didn't really like each other, but NHTSA retained his security clearances. He had been sort of in the room during the Korean War when the U.S. was actively considering using nuclear weapons. It's one of the few times that really came to that granularity. And so he became the takeaway from that is he really developed himself in as an expert who would be taken seriously by everyone, because he really understood how things worked and the dilemmas of U.S. policymaking. And so I think that's something that, you know, everyone aspiring to this role can, you know, consider that, you know, it can be done, and not necessarily through kind of affixing yourself to partisan backing. The second thing I would say, what he did was, well, I don't know what to jump in time. If I could, I want to say something about important thing that he did in the 1970s in terms of sketching out.
Go ahead.
Should I skip forward over the 60s?
Whatever. I mean, because maybe he does the most important thing later in his life. So if that's
the thing, I'll get to it. I make the case in the book that the most important thing that he does actually comes in the Reagan administration in terms of putting together a framework by which Ronald Reagan and George Shultz could kind of pursue the Strategic Defense Initiative and the blockbuster Strategic Arms Reduction Treaty. But I need to sort of get from point A to point B. So if I could just, you know, for I think that there's an important moment in sort of that trajectory for Paul Nitze, and that's the period of the Berlin crisis and the Cuban Missile Crisis. Nitze at that time is the Assistant Secretary of International Security Affairs, which is the equivalent of the Undersecretary of Defense for Policy today. And so he's, you know, McNamara's top civilian during that period. They have very different interpretations of the resolution, the peaceful resolution of the Cuban Missile Crisis in October of 1962. From McNamara's perspective, according to Nitze, and I sort of agree with this, is that McNamara came away thinking, okay, the two sides have gone to the brink, and we've seen the abyss below, and now we're both going to pull back and not go to that point again. And therefore, you know, we can cap the Minuteman fleet at 1,000, we can do several other things that are sort of, we don't have to be as worried. And from Nitze's perspective, that was complete garbage, that, you know, the Soviets had backed down because of U.S. Strategic and conventional superiority, both of which he saw as kind of on the decline going forward, and that the right thing was supposed to be to sustain that advantage. So the world that, you know, we get to of the early 1970s is much different than 1961 and 1962. I mean, the Soviets take the view, as they say to an American diplomat, you will never do that to us again. That's what they say after the Cuban Missile Crisis. And the world of the 1970s is that you have parity at best, right, with the Soviets, and at worst you have a Soviet Union that just continues to build its strategic capabilities. Now, what did that mean in terms of, you know, practically speaking? And this is where I think that it's really important, his contribution, this kind of thought experiment, which became known as the Nitze scenario. And Adam, you know this, the role of the SS9, and which becomes the SS18, the fear that this instills to kind of some U.S. military planners, in the sense that, you know, this missile that they unveil, they show off at Red Square, is too big. It's sort of too big to achieve the goals of massive assured retaliation, whatever we want to, however you want to call it, massive assured of MAD, massive. Anyway, the
mutually assured destruction.
Mutually assured. I get
that. Okay, don't worry about
but
it.
It's sort of, you know, the point. So it's too big for that. So what is it used for, right? Well, Nitze and others say, well, it must be a counterforce weapon, and it probably is designed to take out U.S. ground-based Minuteman fleet. Now, from Nitze's perspective also, it's sort of, well, that raises the scenario that, you know, they could do that. They would have the ability to do that and spare U.S. cities. And the Soviets would be able to say to an American president, okay, you have a choice here. You can either retaliate against our cities, or, you know, knowing that we will then attack your cities, or you can surrender. And it didn't have to get to that point for this scenario to be important, because in a crisis like the Cuban Missile Crisis, only 10 years later, from Nitze's perspective, the Soviets knew that an American president would always back down in that situation. And Nitze himself, I think, really believed that there was a fundamental difference between the American, whoever was an American president, whoever was a Soviet leader, in the sense that, you know, that the American people would elect somebody with, you know, who would never make that choice. They would never say, all right, like, I'll wipe out 80 million Americans. I mean, you know, Nitze thought no elected American president would take that bargain. And so the lesson of it was that so long as you tolerated this situation, that the Soviets would be tempted to take risks or elsewhere in the world. And from him, from his perspective, that's how you get the collapse of detente in the late 1970s.
Mm. Okay. So now push us forward to what you think is the second most important.
Well, I think there's another, around the same time, I think he has a reaction to arms control. I'd be curious what you think of this, because it's kind of an enduring point for us, everyone to worry about, is that So NHTSA is, he's involved in the SALT 1 and ABM negotiations as the representative of the Department of Defense. And he's keen on the ABM treaty. He plays a big role in crafting it. He thinks it's a good deal, a good bargain. However, only insofar as it was accompanied by like a more comprehensive arms reduction bargain, which didn't happen. He thought that SALT 1, the interim agreement, was a mistake. But the issue where it becomes an enduring problem, I think, for everyone to consider, is that his rationale was that if you have a modest agreement on arms control, that the American people would kind of move on. They would say, okay, well, we've solved that. Where what needed to happen is that you needed to sustain defense spending in order to have leverage to, you know, get the other side then to agree to the more comprehensive thing. And so that's where I think what he proposes in 1985 to President Reagan and what becomes the kind of the official position in the next year or two is you would have a kind of phased grand agreement that would allow U.S. to pursue the Strategic Defense Initiative while also building the framework of what becomes the START 1 agreement in, that we ultimately signed in 1991. So, I mean, we don't get the full aspirations, obviously, what President Reagan wanted, but I think that, you know, his experience, his role, that is of Paul NHTSA, runs sort of counter to the notion that you can do something only at the start and then later on in your career, you're just kind of living off of those dividends. But I contrast this to George Kennan, who effectively had no impact on U.S. foreign policy making, you know, from 1950 onward. He was a critic, but, you know, he was not in the room, and Paul NHTSA was.
Yeah, that's an interesting point you make. So now, as we come to the end of the show, you know, you would know as a listener that I like to bring out Bob the Genie. And as I rub my magic lamp, you get your three wishes, James. You get three wishes. Yeah. Bob. He doesn't care if you're a historian and not a, you know, a policy guy. He grants historians three wishes. So you can be creative or you can be forward looking. You can be back, you know, look to the rear, whatever you want to do.
Well, I think my biggest wish is that I encourage listeners to peruse the main project of my life, which is the Foreign Relations of the United States series at history.state.gov, particularly to, as we wrestle again with questions of extended deterrence, particularly in Europe, topics that came up in the 1950s, very much as you know. And I think that there are a lot of things that people have forgotten that, whether we like it or not, are back in our lives. And the second thing is that I wish that people of all parties, of all political stripes, you know, read what I know you've read a lot, which is the Madeleine Creed and Frank Miller's work on the leading the work that they led on the national, the Congressional Commission on making sure that we... strategic posture, because I do think it is incredible to me that there is the consensus of the things that we need to do over the long term. And that to me is unique. As you know, as I kind of jump around time, right, from the 70s to the 80s to today, it is unique that there is consensus to that. And I do think this needs to be nurtured and sustained. And then the third thing I think is that people, you know, we have to kind of think hard about what will be the future of ensuring strategic stability, you know, a combination of deterrence, mutual restraint, possibly some agreements, but I'm, you know, the first two are probably the most important things. And, you know, sometimes just be humble about how much more complicated I fear the so-called three-body problem is of the United States, Russia, and the People's Republic of China. I mean, I sometimes think maybe everything I've worked on or thought about is irrelevant because it was so much simpler and was just two parties. But I'm sustain myself in hoping that there are kind of, you know, smaller points that can be teased out, particularly of the history at our website, that can be potentially refurbished and applied to the challenges that, you know, we're all going to face for the rest of our lives.
Yeah, it's funny you say that, because I've started going back, and a friend of mine, Curtis McGiffin, he and I, we find these great books that were written in the 70s, 80s, and we're like, holy cow, everybody's forgotten these books, you know, The Treaty Trap or Arms Control Delusion, and you go back and you read them and you're like, holy cow, these are great ideas. How did we never hear about these before? Because they're so relevant for today. And so the point that you're making, that there's a lot of, you know, useful wisdom to learn from the past, because in many instances we've done that before, I think is spot on. You know, it's like, what do they always say? You know, analogies are always wrong, but they're sometimes useful.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
You know, it's kind of like that. So, yeah. So in your sort of your elevator speech for the listeners, what do you want them to know in this last minute about Paul Nitze? What's their takeaway, you know, their takeaway point?
I think that, if you know something about Paul, if you heard of Paul Nitze, you may have heard the line that he was known as saying, that I do what my body tells me to at age 70. And I want them to know that that was totally bogus, that he was, you know, flesh and blood as everyone else. He was fortunate to be rich, and so he could take vacations, go back to his farm, go to Aspen. And for everyone in the national security enterprise, you have to understand that, you know, you have to take care of yourselves, your mental and physical health, and do not think that people like Paul Nitze in the Cold War were somehow more invincible than you. They didn't show it. They didn't let on.
Yeah. All right. Well, thanks. It's a great book. Enjoyed it. You know, I think I read it for, you know, the publisher, and it was great. So for all the listeners out there, go pick up a copy. You'll enjoy it, and it'll make you think. It'll make you think about your career, because it made me think about mine. So thanks for joining us, and thanks for being on NucleCast.
Thank you so much, Adam.
And thanks to you, the listeners, and we'll see you next time. I don't know about you, but I often, you know, I like reading. I'm a biography reader, because I like to try to gain sort of pearls of wisdom for my own self, you know, and I sort of say, you know, hey, am I working as hard as I can? Or, you know, am I having the impact I would like to have? I think about that kind of stuff a lot. And so it was, you know, it was a good book to see, you know, one of the most prominent people in national security. And so I enjoyed the conversation with James, and, you know, the book is well written. It's a great book. So if you haven't read it, pick up a copy and sort of see what you can learn from it as well.
This has been a production of the ANWA Deterrence Center, a 501c3 that seeks to educate key decision makers, stakeholders, and the public to ensure a broader understanding of the nation's strategic nuclear deterrent. Our executive producer is Kimberly Charrington, and this episode has been engineered and mixed by David Grunthal. Help us grow our followers by sharing it, and follow the show on LinkedIn, Facebook, and Twitter at NucleCast.